Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Gordy LaChance, a former U.S. Army sergeant and Iraq war veteran, who discusses the deteriorating conditions in Iraq and the coming U.S. election. Former Israeli and Palestinian fighters, who, while on a U.S. tour, are calling for a nonviolent solution to the decades-long Middle East conflict. And Lewis Lapham, longtime editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Pretensions to Empire, who examines the severe harm he feels President Bush and his administration have inflicted on U.S. democracy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russia has forced nearly 100 international non-government organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, to halt operations for missing a deadline for registration. The tough new registration law on NGOs is seen as a move by President Vladimir Putin to restrict the actions of human rights and pro-democracy groups that are often critical of his government. On October the 15th, the Moscow office of Human Rights Watch had stopped conducting interviews with victims of human rights abuses and halted participation in public events. The aid group Doctors Without Borders has shut down several humanitarian projects in Chechnya and a clinic for homeless children in Moscow. Still, the registration flap has not stopped Human Rights Watch from criticizing the Putin record on human rights. On October the 18th, the monitoring group issued a press release condemning a police attack on peaceful protesters at a memorial service for the murdered Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya in the state of Ingushetia. At one point, police pulled protesters out of their cars, then pushed and beat them. None of the police or plainclothes officers were detained afterwards. However, authorities detained five human rights activists and a journalist. The National Republican Campaign Committee gave up early on its hardline anti-immigration candidate, Randy Graff, by pulling a $1 million ad campaign in his southern Arizona district in late September. Graff, a former pro golfer and ally of the Minutemen, a militant anti-immigrant group, beat the party establishment in a hotly contested September 12th primary in the moderate district that stretches from Tucson to the Mexican border. But Graff failed to win the backing in the fall election from Arizona's two Republican senators, John McCain and John Kyle. Outgoing Republican Jim Colby had represented Arizona's 8th congressional district for 22 years. Post-primary polls showed Democrat Gabriel Giffords, a former state senator, beating Graff 48-35% in the district where immigration is the number one hot-button issue. Gifford supports the Enforcement Plus formula embodied in the bipartisan McCain-Kennedy immigration bill. Soon afterward, the GOP cancelled its ad campaign. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee also pulled its ad from the district. Growing Latino political activism has raised the political fortunes for Giffords, a centrist Democrat. In April, 15,000 people filled the streets of Tucson in favor of liberalized immigration rules, and much of that energy has spilled into the congressional election. While working in the White House, Ken Melman, the current head of the Republican National Committee, did some favors for corrupt lobbyist Jack Abramoff. According to the Los Angeles Times, Melman, while employed as White House political director, had State Department staffer Alan Stamen fired. Stamen, who worked to improve labor conditions in Pacific Island nations, ran into opposition from Abramoff on behalf of his client, the Northern Mariana Islands. Emails released by the House Government Reform Committee document that an aide to Abramoff said in 2001 that, quote, Melman said he would get him fired. Melman also helped another Abramoff client, the Mississippi Choctaw Indians, win a $16.3 million contract for a new jail over the objections of the U.S. Justice Department, who thought the current facility was adequate. In November 2001, an aide to then-House Majority Leader Tom DeLay referred the disputed jail contract to Melman. The Indian tribe soon afterwards donated $10,000 to the Republican National Committee. A few weeks later, Mississippi Congressman Charles Pickering talked with Melman about the contract impasse. The money was then soon released. Congressman Henry Waxman, a powerful Los Angeles Democrat, claims Melman also violated ethics rules in his dealing with Abramoff by accepting tickets to a U2 concert. This happened while Melman was trying to get rid of Stamen, the State Department staffer. Ethics rules prohibit officials from accepting gifts of more than $20 from a person doing business with the government. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Even before October was over, the month was on track to become the deadliest for U.S. soldiers since the November 2004 assault on the town of Fallujah. By October 24th, 91 American troops had been killed, bringing the total for the war up to 2,800 since President Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. The conflict has been exponentially more deadly for Iraqi civilians. The prestigious British medical journal The Lancet recently published a study by three Johns Hopkins University epidemiologists, which found that more than 600,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed in the war thus far, a conclusion dismissed by President Bush and the Pentagon. As the congressional election draws near and the situation in Iraq deteriorates with an increase in insurgent attacks, suicide bombings, and death squad murders, Mr. Bush has altered his rhetoric and dropped his trademark slogan of "Stay the Course." It seems that with the GOP likely headed for defeat in the November ballot, the White House is desperately trying to indicate that a change of policy on Iraq is being considered. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Gordy LaChance, a U.S. Army sergeant who served a year in Iraq with the 1st Infantry Division ending in February 2005. Now retired from the military, LaChance, an activist with the group Iraq Veterans Against the War, discusses the worsening conditions in Iraq and the coming U.S. election.
I didn't fight terrorism, as a lot of your regular news media talk about. Al-Qaeda and all of that, I fought with your shopkeepers. People who were just like yourself, you know, radio operators, just doing a radio station, people who were running the meat store on the side of the street, the guy who was running the gasoline store. And these were people that didn't want to fight, but they're at a point where they have no choice. We destroyed their entire infrastructure once when we came in the invasion, between all the bombing we did, and then when we got there, even though, I mean, there were operations to rebuild this infrastructure, we were constantly always destroying it. I mean, power was unreliable. You might have it for an hour or two here, and then 2 days later, you'd get out of power again. So you can't run a business if you don't have power. Families can't maintain their farm if they don't have power. I remember many, many times, I mean, Iraqis, that's what they would talk to you about. You know, why don't I have power? Why don't I have water? Why can't I send my child to school? Because they're being shot. I'm losing my children because of you. And it wasn't because of insurgents killing them. It was because of Americans fighting so-called insurgents that were only defending their own country. That really began to gruel inside of you after a while. Many cases, my squad, myself, being a sergeant, hard to talk about this one, but we engaged the enemy shooting at us, and in the crossfire, innocent civilians on numerous occasions were shot, wounded, and killed. And that only kind of creates enemies. And it's a difficult thing to deal with.
Mark, tell us a bit about your view of the current situation in Iraq. We read in the papers daily about the escalating body count of the Iraqi civilian population with the inter-ethnic death squads and what has to be viewed now as a civil war. And at the same time, of course, you've got many more U.S. soldiers that are being killed. October registering one of the highest death tolls among U.S. Servicemen and women in recent years. What's your view of the situation over there right now?
My view is that it's all going to hell over there. No, it's already gone to hell, and it's only getting worse. It drives me nuts to watch the news. Many times I have to shut it off because I see it, and I can't believe that still most people don't realize and understand that there's really a war going on over there, and that our soldiers being there are agitating it even more. And for people to stand there and say, and stand in a news media cast or whatever and go, well, we need to send more troops to take care of the problem, just boggles my mind. The stay the course whole thing boggles my mind, because how I look at it is, if we were here in the United States and Iraq came to us and said, well, you know what, we don't like your dictator, so we're going to take him out, and now we're going to give you a government, everybody in this country would be doing the same thing that the Iraqis are trying to do for theirs. People don't understand that. It doesn't matter if it's 10 Iraqis over here trying to change our life, or those 150,000 or 200,000 or 500,000. People are going to fight for what they believe in. And the fact that we as America have not figured that out yet and are continuing to send U.S. soldiers over there, and they're dying, and it keeps getting worse every month, and they're like, well, you know, eventually the Iraqis will stand up, so it's going to be okay. It's just, it's insane to me.
Many people are looking at this midterm congressional election as a referendum on President Bush and his leading the nation into war in Iraq, and certainly the calamity that's led to for U.S. forces and the Iraqi people. As an Iraq veteran, what do you want the American people to know when they go into the voting booth? And to what use do you think their vote should be cast in terms of the future involvement of the United States in Iraq?
If they want troops out and want to withdraw, then they're already looking right to me. But when troops come home, they can't just be brought home and treated as heroes. They're going to need to be taken care of. And I want to find people who are along those same lines. And I have yet to find anybody who is addressing that type of veteran issues. I think this is a referendum on George Bush, and it's definitely going to define what will happen into Iraq. But I don't think that the outcome of this upcoming election is going to pull soldiers out. I think no matter who comes into power, soldiers are still going to stay there, and that's unfortunate.
What would you yourself like to see? I mean, there are various proposals floating around from Democrats and even some disaffected Republicans that say there should be a timeline for withdrawal, some benchmarks that the Iraqi government should meet as a way of moving the United States toward an ultimate withdrawal later on down the line. But what do you think yourself should happen?
There needs to be a total and immediate withdrawal, not a timeline, and not because we don't want to give the so-called enemy a timeline. It needs to happen as soon as possible. I mean, given, granted, you can't pull out 150,000 soldiers in the same day, but there needs to be an immediate withdrawal of all U.S. forces and U.S. contractors as well, and that needs to happen as soon as possible. The whole timeline thing, it doesn't make any sense. Why are you going to spread it out? Because it's still going to, deaths are still going to continue to compile. Iraq financing will just continue to skyrocket, and that needs to end in order to help benefit everybody all the way around. And that's only going to happen with a complete withdrawal, like immediate.
That was retired U.S. Army Sergeant Mark Gordy LeChance, a veteran of the Iraq War, now active with Iraq Veterans Against the War. Contact the group by calling area code 215-241-7123 or visit their website at www.ivaw.org. As Palestinians continue to suffer and die under the policies of the Israeli government in Gaza and the West Bank, and as Israelis still suffer under the threat of suicide bombings, a group of former fighters from both sides have come together to put their own experience and suffering on the line to call for a nonviolent solution to the decades-long Middle East conflict. The war veterans propose the creation of a viable Palestinian state to exist alongside Israel. Two members of the group, Combatants for Peace, are currently on a speaking tour of the U.S. from October 23rd through November 3rd, sponsored nationally by Faculty for Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Their second stop was Yale University, where they told their stories and then invited questions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recorded the event and presents several excerpts of their stories. We first hear from Suleiman Khatib, a former Palestinian fighter, followed by Yonatan Shapira, a former captain in the Israeli Air Force Reserves and co-founder of Combatants for Peace.
I born 1972, after the Six-Day War. I born near Ramallah, in my village, surrounded by the settlements and soldiers all the time. At that time, it was forbidden for us to have the Palestinian flag in the schools, and so we start in the schools with the other children to bring the Palestinian flag inside the school. Then we start sometimes close the schools, demonstrations, throw stones and Molotov. At the end, I joined Fatah militia, try to kill Israeli soldiers. It led me, at the end of the day, I found myself in the jail, the Israeli jail, when I was 14 years old. they judged me for 15 years, and I spent 10 years and 5 months in the Israeli jails.
Khatib said after his release from prison, he gradually came in contact with both Palestinian and Israeli former fighters who saw violence as a dead end.
They came to the result at the end of the day. From both sides, there are no military solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This is simply our experience with the conflict. And we personally paid price for the conflict there. We start also bring more and more members from both sides. And we start holding big meetings every month for 50 ex-fighters from both sides, also secret, underground, because we don't know exactly the reaction in both sides. Our goal, short, frankly, and simply, to end the occupation, the Israeli occupation, with non-violence way, and to end the violence between both sides.
Yonatan Shapira fulfilled a boyhood dream of becoming a pilot in the Israeli Air Force, but found he was flying missions over occupied Palestinian territory.
What happened to me in this story is that I understood that I'm part of this circle of violence and I didn't want anymore to continue to be part of this circle. But at the beginning, I was waiting for someone else, someone stronger, smarter, that looks better or that speaks better than me, to do something about that. But nothing happened. And once you understand that it must be you that starts something, it gives you a lot of power, a lot of courage. And what I started to do is to go from one pilot to another and checking who is willing to participate with me in an initiative of writing a refusal letter that will be published in Israel so everyone can see it and everyone can know that there are Israeli pilots, Israeli officers that refuse to participate in this circle of mutual violence that will lead us to self-destruction. We ended up 3 years ago at the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the new Jewish year, with 27 pilots from different squadrons. And we published this letter in which we declared that we refused to take any more part in the attacks on Palestinian cities in the Palestinian occupied territories. As a result of that, it created a big uproar in the Israeli society. Some called us traitors, but many others told us that it's the first time in years that they felt some kind of hope that maybe something different will happen, maybe something will change now. At a poll that they made just a few days after the letter was published, they said that about 20% of the Jewish Israeli society, Israeli population, said that they will sign the letter. So it's about 1 million citizens, which was very surprising for us to see. Since then, many things happened, and I will try to make it short now. But the idea of making the first step and refuse to participate in things that you believe are illegal and immoral is just the first step. The second step is after you refuse to enter the occupied territories with your gun, now go there without your gun and listen, look, talk, and meet the people that you were fighting before. Maybe you can find something in common. And that's how everything started. My brother, my older brother, Zoha, was also a commando soldier in Sayeret Matkal, the elite commando soldier. He also refused and organized a petition of commando soldiers. And he was the first who approached Suleiman's friend in Bethlehem. And that's how everything started with the Combatants for Peace. I will end up just with the breaking news that just yesterday, Avigdor Lieberman, who is a new member now in the Israeli government, he's one of the deputies of the prime minister, is the new strategic threat minister in the Israeli government. And this guy is a racist, fascist person. In a way, it's terrible. It's terrible to see him in the government. It's terrible what the government is doing. It's terrible what your government is doing. It's terrible by what many governments are doing. But maybe there is one advantage here. And the advantage is that the facade of the Israeli government now will be more like the inside.
That was Palestinian Suleiman Khatib and Yonatan Shapira of Combatants for Peace. They will be touring college campuses in the Northeast, Midwest, and West Coast through November 3rd. For more information, visit the group's website at www.combatantsforpeace.org. As the nation prepares to vote in the November 7th congressional election, a near-perfect storm of bad news for Republicans has prompted many political observers to predict a once-or-twice-in-a-generation vote that will usher in dramatic change in which party controls the legislative branch. The scandal involving former Florida Representative Mark Foley for his sexually inappropriate emails to congressional pages and allegations of a leadership cover-up is just the latest episode that has caused an increasing number of voters to turn against the GOP. Escalating violence in Iraq, incompetence in responding to Hurricane Katrina, an expanding web of corruption scandals, federal budget deficits, and following the radical agenda of the Christian right regarding stem cell research and intervention in the case of Terri Schiavo have all contributed to polls that found that only 26% of Americans approve of the way Congress has been doing its job. Lewis Lapham, longtime editor of Harper's Magazine, has throughout his career eloquently and effectively challenged those in power. In his new book, Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration, Lapham chronicles the misconduct and ineptitude of Mr. Bush and his White House team. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lewis Lapham about the crisis for democracy he believes the nation must now confront.
The abuse of power on the part of the executive, which is, runs through a number of different specific acts. In other words, it's the attack on the Constitution, the attack on the idea of separation of powers, the reduction of the Congress to a pretty much a tame dog or a rubber stamp or a sitting duck that simply obliges the administration with whatever the administration wants, and the administration refusing to give to the Congress details of its own decisions. Bush, I think by now, has issued something like 120 signing statements where he simply by executive privilege overrides legislation that's been passed by the Congress. It's the use of warrantless wiretaps. It's the refusal to recognize international treaties which we have signed. It's the placing of any decision by the military tribunals with regard to suspicious persons or detainees beyond the jurisdiction of the American courts. In other words, no American court under the new bill has the right to question the president's acts. And the president also reserves to himself the right to name anybody he chooses to name as an enemy combatant. In other words, it's a consistent pattern of anti-democratic sentiment, a refusal to listen to people that whose views might contradict those of the president or his immediate circle of advisors. It's the usurpation of power. I mean, this is what they were talking about when they were writing the Declaration of Independence. And that's a consistent pattern throughout the life of this administration, and it's dangerous. And people have to see this as a constitutional question. This is not a question of Democrats punishing Republicans. It's a question of the Congress asserting its constitutional authority and responsibility.
In regards to this coming midterm congressional election, many people view it as a referendum on the Bush administration's performance as well as the performance of a Congress that has been marked by corruption and, as you said, a case of rubber stamping most everything that President Bush wanted with very little scrutiny and very little accountability. If the polls are correct and the Democrats take one or both houses of Congress, do you see the Democrats actually moving into a position where they will aggressively pursue investigations and hold this administration accountable for what they have done in twisting the words of our founding documents as a nation, the Constitution?
Well, I would hope so. I suspect that even if you have a narrow Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate, I suspect that nothing will happen along these lines, and people will say to themselves, well, we'll wait for 2 years, and then we will replace Bush by the orderly transfers of power that happen, you know, every 4 years. You know, they will opt to do nothing. You know, there'll be some talk about withdrawing troops from Iraq, and maybe there'll be some talk about rescinding the tax cuts, and maybe even some talk about the minimum wage and a provision of health insurance for everybody in the United States. But I don't think it would come to anything more than talk. I doubt that they're apt to have a very strong majority, and even if they did, I think that the Democrats, the Democratic Party as a whole, lacks both the will and the conviction to address what I think is a constitutional question. And I think, you know, they will say, well, we have a sham democracy, and we're perfectly happy with that.
With that gloomy prediction, I'm wondering, we have seen periods in this nation's history in the 1930s and the 40s and the 60s where grassroots movements have succeeded in some part in pushing progressive change. Do you think the pendulum is swinging back to a time where grassroots movements can once again be the leaders in terms of pushing politicians to do the right thing and to move forward in redressing some of the inequities of the country, as well as reversing some of these policies that have been put in place by the Bush administration and going well beyond that?
Well, I think that could happen. I mean, there is a lot of unrest or discontent or argumentative sentiment at large in the American public as a whole, but it needs somebody to articulate the constitutional idea and what do we mean by democracy. I mean, I think democracy allies itself with change, with the notion that there are no final solutions, that nobody knows enough, and that we can all learn from each other if we listen to each other. But we now, I think, maybe have come down too far down the road toward an idea of America as the state, that is to say, of some sort of empire, which really doesn't serve the interests of the American people.
That was Lewis Lapham, longtime editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration. Visit Harper's website at www.harpers.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anon, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.